the New World. Episode 2, The Old World. Last time, I discussed the Viking exploration and settlement of Vinland. While I'd like to think that the events discussed in the last episode are groundbreaking and world-changing, they act more as a prologue for what was to come than anything else. While they do deserve credit for being the first to cross the Atlantic, they simply aren't as important as what was to come. Although it should be worth noting that by the time this episode takes place, the late 1400s, the last of the Vikings living on Greenland were dying off. However, their impact on future exploration was minimal. Apologies to the estate of Bjarni Herjolfsson. Today I wanted to discuss what was happening in Europe that led to the so-called Age of Exploration, where Western European nations suddenly began sending ships full of men off into uncharted waters with hopes of fortune and glory. Obviously, Europe was on the verge of a big change in 1491, but in the 50 years beforehand it had already gone through a great many changes that reshaped the way the social, economic, religious, and political landscapes had been for centuries. 1453 marked an incredibly important year in European history. In 1453, Mehmed II, the ruler of the Ottoman Empire, battered down the Theodosian walls with great cannons and marched down the streets of Constantinople. The Byzantine Empire, also known as the Eastern Roman Empire, an institution which had been clinging on to life for more than 1,000 years, was over. The Greek-speaking scholars and intellectuals, which had fled the city after its fall, migrated over to the many wealthy merchant cities of northern Italy, beginning a renewed interest in ancient Greek and Roman culture, science, and history. We call this cultural revival the Renaissance, but it was not the only development in Europe. Massive cathedrals were being raised in major cities across the continent, and non-religious art was making a big comeback. In 1453, Johannes Gutenberg's printing press was beginning to make a serious impact in the world of literature. No longer would monks have to sit around painstakingly copying books for years at a time. Now Europe had movable block printing, where letters could individually be arranged on a press to create unique prints every time. While printing books was certainly nothing new in Asia and the Middle East, Gutenberg's design set off a wave of mechanization and manufacturing that allowed literature to be spread at a rate never before seen in European society. Authors such as Geoffrey Chaucer and Dante Alighieri were only a few examples of people whose books found widespread publication, but ideas were spreading just as well. One such idea that the printing press helped to spread was dissatisfaction with the church. The medieval Catholic Church's hold on society was beginning to slip slightly. Issues like the selling of indulgences and other misuses of funds by the papacy were leaving many with questions on how the words of Jesus Christ should be interpreted. While Martin Luther wouldn't be nailing his 95 Theses to a church door until 1517, other would-be reformers of the Christian faith had already been burned at the stake for heresy. These heretical groups like Lollards in England and the Hussites in Bohemia would prove to be unlucky predecessors of the looming Protestant Reformation, which would shake Catholicism to its core. By the late 1400s, even the social systems that had defined European society were beginning to change. We tend to think of the Middle Ages as a time of feudalism, where serfs were bound to their lands, ruled over by knights, barons, dukes, and counts. Now, more and more of the peasantry were beginning to be freed from their lifelong bondage. Although the Black Death had decimated the known world, populations were recovering, and cities were filling back up. The old feudal society that was made up of those who fought, those who prayed, and those who worked was no longer necessarily the rule. Wealthy merchants who owned their allegiance to no lord lived in the republican city-states of Italy or the free cities of the Hanseatic League in Germany, making obscene amounts of money off trade routes that extended to the Muslim world and beyond. They paid bands of mercenaries clad in steel armor and wielding relatively new gunpowder weapons to fight their wars for them. In places like these, wealth was not strictly tied to the amount of land or the number of peasants you controlled. Lastly, but perhaps most important to our story, the political entities we now think of as the modern nations of France, Spain, and England, and others, were beginning to take a recognizable shape. With many of their age-old conflicts like the Hundred Years' War and the Reconquista resolving, they began to look outward in big ways. The wealth of Asia was beginning to be closed off to them by armies of middlemen between China and Italy, and the wealth of Africa was now within reach thanks to new technology like the caravel ship and a new interest in exploration. Let's have a closer look at the Iberian Peninsula, because they are going to be the main drivers of our story for the next few episodes. In 1453, it was divided into several different nations that had been in conflict with one another for as long as they had existed. On the west coast lay the Kingdom of Portugal, which had already begun its own program of exploration and conquest along the coast of Africa. More on them later. In the middle lay the Crown of Castile, a very powerful kingdom and perhaps the biggest power on the peninsula. On the east coast lay Castile's chief rival, the Crown of Aragon, which had many holdings in the Mediterranean, including most of southern Italy. To the north, among the Pyrenees Mountains, was the Basque-speaking Kingdom of Navarra, which, in all honesty, is pretty unimportant. Finally, along the southern coast was the Islamic Emirate of Granada. In the 700 years since the Umayyad Caliphate first landed in Iberia, Muslims and Christians had engaged in an on-again, off-again series of holy wars, referred to as the Reconquista. Muslim rulers once controlled everything from Lisbon to Barcelona, with only the northwestern Kingdom of Asturias to resist them. But now, the thin strip of land in Granada was all that was left, and it was not long for this world. As I said, Portugal had already begun its forays into the world of exploration. In 1420, the Portuguese sent a military expedition to the city of Ceuta on the northern coast of Morocco. They captured the city, but one of the commanders of the siege, Prince Henry the Navigator, could not help but wonder what else Africa had to offer. He sent several exploration ventures out into the sea, discovering the uninhabited islands of Madeira and the Azores. This is pretty impressive, especially considering the fact that both of these places are hundreds of miles away from Portugal. Spurred on by success and eyeing the famous gold mines of the Niger River in West Africa, Henry sent more explorers around Cape Bojador in 1434, something no other European had ever done before. The source that I read claimed that it was rumored your skin turned black if you did so from the scorching heat. More of West Africa was explored, including Cape Verde and the so-called Gold Coast, all the way down south to modern-day Cameroon. The idea emerged that it was possible to sail all the way to India itself and acquire the wealth of the East at its source. By 1488, 4 years before the big voyage across the Atlantic, Bartolomeu Dias rounded the Cape of Good Hope at present-day South Africa. And he would have gone further if his terrified crew hadn't unanimously voted to turn back to Portugal. The Portuguese had other motives for these trips, though. The royal family thought it might be possible to somehow attack Islamic North Africa from the south, enticed by the myth of Prester John's Christian kingdom in Africa. Also, they had already gained an interest in black African slaves. Slavery itself had never really gone away in Iberia after the fall of Rome, and Christians and Muslims enslaved one another for manual labor regularly. It's an unfortunate fact of life of this time and place that will have disastrous results in the centuries to come. If you'd like to know more about Portuguese colonization in the East, I'd recommend listening to the History of Colonization podcast. It's quite good. And Fidelity actually gave me some help in setting up my own show. Thank you. political matters might have continued a while longer in their usual fashion, had it not been for one very important wedding. King Enrique of Castile, a guy who seems to be pretty mediocre in all aspects, nominated his sister Isabel as his heir after his brother Alfonso died, potentially in a plot to secure the young princess as a more impressionable ruler. This was great and terrible news for Isabel, who was unmarried and had several potential suitors, most notably from France, England, and even Portugal. All of these were politically beneficial to Castile, but she decided on her second cousin, none other than Fernando, heir to the throne of Aragon. He was brave and charismatic, and she was politically savvy, if not a little humorless. Plus, they were only a year apart in age, with Isabel being the older one. They were married in 1469, when Isabel was 17 and Fernando 16. When King Enrique died in December of 1474, Fernando sped over to the town of Segovia, where Isabel waited, and by January, they had worked out an agreement on sharing power over both of their kingdoms. Although Castile and Aragon would remain technically separate until the early 1700s, this marks the beginning of a united Kingdom of Spain. Not all was going great for this power couple, however. The Marquis of Villena, Diego Pacheco, declared that Isabel was not the rightful ruler of Castile, and that instead it should be Juana, the 12-year-old daughter of the late Enrique. Several other Castilian nobles backed him up, but among his allies was none other than Alfonso, King of Portugal. Alfonso had once wanted to marry Isabel, but now it seemed he saw his chance to take Castile the hard way. He married Juana, his own niece, and sent a Portuguese army to support the Marquis. It seems that Isabel was going to be in for a fight, and that Castile was going to unite with somebody, whether it was to be Aragon or Portugal. Well, after all that setup, the payoff isn't going to be very climactic. In March of 1476, Alfonso's army met Fernando's army outside the city of Toro, where Fernando utterly crushed the Portuguese. Fighting continued for a little while longer, but things were pretty much over right then and there. In the peace treaty, Spain was guaranteed the Canary Islands off the coast of Morocco, the beginnings of their colonial empire. A year later, Fernando ascended to the throne of Aragon, and the Iberian wedding was cemented. In 1482, the stage was set for the final battle of the Reconquista. With Portugal pacified and a treaty signed with France, there was no one else to distract Isabel and Fernando from finishing Muslim rule in Iberia forever. Granada had paid tribute in money and soldiers to the rulers of Castile for decades. But in 1480, the emir Hassan stopped that practice. He also attacked the Castilian city of Zahara de la Sierra, giving our Spanish power couple all the reason they needed to start a war. Unfortunately for the emir, he was ousted by plotters not long afterwards, replaced by Mohammed XII. Mohammed had no choice but to continue the war, but no help arrived from North Africa as he expected. Regardless, the war dragged on for 10 long years. Isabel and Ferdinand utilized mercenaries and would-be crusaders from across Europe, and new technology such as fancy new cannons and the first easy-to-use handheld gunpowder weapon, the arquebus. The Spanish ground down the Granadans, siege by siege and battle by battle, until only the city of Granada itself was left. On January 2nd, 1492, Muhammad, himself captured in battle by the Spanish, delivered the surrender, a mile away in the town of Santa Fe. The Reconquista, and indeed the Middle Ages as a whole, were well and truly over, and a new Spanish nation had arisen. As for the now stateless Muslim Moriscos, Isabel and Ferdinand would unleash the Spanish Inquisition on them. Over the next century, the Muslim minority of Spain would be converted, expelled, or imprisoned in large numbers, with many Jews being targeted as well. After the surrender, Isabel and Ferdinand were approached by a tall, white-haired man with a strange Italian-ish accent. They knew him well, of course. He was a trader and would-be explorer who had spent 5 years at the Spanish court warming relations with the nobility. He wanted to convince the monarchs for funding so he could organize an expedition to the west, across the open ocean. The Spanish called him Cristobal Colón, but we know him as, well, you know.